My name is Bob Darrell. I am an alcoholic. All right. One of the last things it says in the sex inventory, if this becomes troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. So if in your groups, if you see some old timers that are doing a lot of 12-step work, and you think to yourself, well, these are just kind, altruistic, giving people. It may not be the truth. It may be that they have a lot of really sick relationship problems, and so they're doing what the book said and throwing themselves the harder into helping others. So I finished the 4-step. I get together with my sponsor. I do a 5th step. I'm not going to talk too much about that. The book makes some pretty good suggestions about who you do it with. Closed mouthed, very important. You want to be able to trust that they're not going to blab it around. Closed mouthed, understanding friend. Later on, the book was written in 1939, when the population worldwide in Alcoholics Anonymous was barely 80 people. And they said in the book that you might want to take it with clergy or et cetera, a doctor. And then years later, after Alcoholics Anonymous had grown in numbers, they suggested in the 12 steps and 12 traditions that the best case scenario is to do it with your sponsor. The best case scenario is to do it with someone who's done it with someone who's stayed sober a while and that's familiar with your case. Your sponsor is the best person. And I'll tell you why I think that's crucial. And there's nothing wrong with doing it with your priest if you do it with your sponsor also. And the reason that it's important to do it with one person is that you're going to need some very specific direction and accountability in the 8th and 9th step process. You don't do that alone. That can be very dangerous to be done alone, your 8th and 9th step, because you can cause more harm. And so you want, if your sponsor heard your 5th step, so he gets it, he gets what's going on, so when it comes time for your 8th and 9th step, he's on board. And he's familiar with the suggestions in this book of the things to do and the things not to do. So that's your best case scenario, and to do it. It's dangerous to sit on this stuff. I had one sponsee who started his 4th step when he was a little over a year sober, and he didn't do his 5th step until he was over 3 years sober. And by the time he did his 5th step, he was carrying a machine gun in his Bronco because they were back. Do you know what I mean? He just incrementally got more anxious and more uptight and more on the... Because once you open that can of worms, you want to get through to the other side as quickly as possible. A torturous thing is to write an in-depth, honest, genuine 4th step and then sit on it for a year or two. I think that's just crazy making stuff. So you want to proceed as quickly as possible. And that takes us to the transition between step 5 and step 6 and 7. It's on page 75. It says, this is immediately after taking your 5th step. It says you return home and find a place where you can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what you have done. So you're going to look back over your 4th and 5th step. You're quiet, it's just you and God. Got the 4th step right there. You're going to take a look at it. Look at what you did. Remember what you talked about with your sponsor. There's a prayer, the next action. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. I had a guy years ago ask me, he said, it was kind of a good question. He said, well, it says we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better, but what if you don't feel like you know him better? And I thought, well, that's a good question, I guess. And well, you know something? It doesn't say We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better if we feel like it. It just says, do it. And maybe it's a leap of faith. Maybe what you really feel is tired and washed out. But we're trusting that we have just removed some of the things that have been between me and God, and I actually am closer to him. And so we trust in that, and I thank him for the opportunity. I take this book down from the shelf, turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, carefully reading the first five steps, first five proposals, and then there's another prayer. And this is an important one. I ask if I've omitted anything, because I'm building an arch through which I shall walk a free man at last. And it is not uncommon to go home after a fifth step, get quiet with God, look over what you just did, say to God, God, if I admit, is there anything I left out? And all of a sudden, something will just float to the surface, almost like one of those eight balls you turn over and the thing floats up to the top. And it wasn't even that you were consciously leaving it out. It's just that it was ferreted so deep down in your consciousness that now that you've got all this other stuff out, you've opened a channel between you and God. Some graces come in, and the graces kind of floated the rest of the stuff. It's not uncommon that stuff will come to the surface over the next year, things that you weren't conscious of before, and maybe even beyond that. And that's perfectly all right. If you're at home, you say the prayer, something flies to the surface, something comes up, and you thought, oh my God, I didn't say that, I needed to call my sponsor. Perfectly all right. I've had that happen several occasions. You know, 45 minutes, I send a guy home, 45 minutes, he calls me up. Bob, I forgot to tell you about the sheep. Well, I want you to know you're not a bad guy. or maybe something really bad, like I forgot to tell you that I stole some money at work. Oh, really? How much? $450,000. Oh, forgot that, did you? Wow, I would have too. Yeah. I would have forgot that. I would have really tried to forget that one. Yeah. But it's okay. So it's not uncommon that happens, and doesn't mean you did something wrong. It means that it's in divine order. Just respond to it. That's all. And so when on top of page 76, we enter into the section on step 6. So off all the questions on the bottom of 75, the book says if we can answer those to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. I have a sponsee that refers to step 6 as the Judas step. Because if one of the 12 betrays you, chances are it's 6. Step 6 is easy to placate and difficult to do. And I, for a lot of reasons, and I've struggled with this step. When I did my first good, a little over 4 years, in my first good fourth and fifth step, I kind of sloughed over step 6. I didn't even say the prayer. I went right to the seventh step prayer. There's actually a 6-step prayer. I didn't even know it. And it's the last line in the first paragraph. It says, if we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us to be willing. And I don't know if I, looking back, I don't know if I left that out consciously or unconsciously. I don't know. But I know that what happened over the next several years was a very difficult time, and it shouldn't have been, but it was, because I was trying to willfully suppress my defects of character, and I didn't even realize that's what I was doing. But see, this fourth step was so perception changing that I came away from it with a whole new view of the world. The difference between this, the one I did at a little over 4 years and the other two were so dramatic. Because the other two, if you'd asked me after it was over, what was the exact nature of your wrongs, I might have told you about a sex thing I did that I was ashamed of, or some money I stole, or a guy I dimed out, or I would have told you that stuff. When I came out of the backside of this one, if you'd asked me, I would have told you how wrong I had been about my mother and father, how wrong I'd been about my sister, how wrong I'd been about my exes, how wrong I'd been about the bosses I'd worked for and the people I thought had turned on me. Because now I'm looking at it from an entirely different angle, and I'm wrong. Imagine the ego reduction. What does the ego do the best? It judges. And I've just taken all my judgments, which are in resentments, fears, and then my perception of sex and all my judgments there, and I've dismantled them all bit by bit. It's like every resentment is a case you build against someone, and you just go through every one. Oh, wrong about my mom, wrong about. You can almost feel the ego just notching down. And just to have it right there, how wrong you are. I'll tell you what happened to me. I came out the backside of that fifth step. There was such a peace inside me because I knew I didn't know nothing. You know, I was wrong about everything. And it wasn't a beating myself up wrong. There was a joy about it. Because when you're wrong about everything, you're wrong about everything, the good and the bad. And that's good. One of my favorite stories from Keith, my friend, he died a few years ago with Lou Gehrig's disease, Keith Lewis. And Keith, he said when he first got sober, he was a lot like me. He'd had a lot of therapy. He'd worked in the field. He had a lot of information, a lot of head knowledge about psychiatry and all that stuff. And he gets sober, and his sponsor says to him, Keith, I want you to get a crayon and write across your mirror in the bathroom, write, Keith, you're wrong. And he goes, no. He said, you don't understand. I have a low self-esteem problem. That wouldn't be good for me. His sponsor says, just do it. Keith, you're wrong. So he goes home, and he writes, oh, this is stupid. Keith, you're wrong. Ah. About 2 days later, wakes up in the morning and he knows he's not going to get to see his kids and his wife and never going to see them again. And this job is not working out. And he doesn't know where he's going to get another one. He's probably going to be homeless. Why does he think he's going to stay sober? He never stayed sober before. And oh, my God, what's the use of even getting up today? This is just horrible. Your boss doesn't like you, and it's a bad job. And you know, geez, I probably have a terminal disease. I can feel it coming, you know. He's sinking into this deep depression, and he walks into the bathroom, and he looks in the mirror and says, Keith, you're wrong. And he goes, oh, thank God. So, how do you become entirely ready? You know, when Wilson first was writing the steps, at one time he used the word willing. We became entirely willing. What does that look like? What does entirely willing look like? What does entirely ready look like? This capacity in me of self-delusion is insidious. I really believed that at one point, after I hit this bottom with all these defects of character, after several years of trying to manage them, it's funny, they develop torque. Did you ever notice that? When it's like there's a law in the universe that for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. If I willfully suppress something, it gains torque. There's a part in the book, it talks about that on page 101. And this is really a very accurate description that happens to a lot of us that willfully try to change our own lives and don't have the power to do it. on 101, it's in the second full paragraph, it's talking about schemes for combating alcoholism. Now, I don't think alcoholism has that much to do with drinking. I think the real alcoholism that I struggle with is what happens to me once I get sober, right? And it says, in our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods, these attempts to do the impossible have always failed. And I'd have certain things that are just obviously objectionable from my fourth and fifth step. I get it. And I would try to suppress these things, and then I'd do good for a time, and then I'd have an episode. Maybe where I'm trying to suppress my anger, and then I fly off the handle at someone, and I'm embarrassed. Or maybe I'm trying to suppress my lust, and then I suppress it so long that I'm so vulnerable that I make a bad choice and I go with someone I should never, ever, ever, ever have gone with. And it's like they gain torque. And what am I really doing? Is I don't really want God to take this. And I started to say that willingness prayer, and what I discovered is I don't really want God to remove the defect. I want him to remove the consequences. I'd like to keep, it's like I want to keep drinking. I just don't want the rests and the hangovers. You know, I want God to take the consequences. And I wanted to do that with the defects. And why? Why would I do that? Well, because I've depended on them for decades for security. What all my defects of character, in effect, are defective defense mechanisms. What is anger? Except a defense mechanism when I'm threatened, so people won't take advantage of me, so you won't roll over me, so you won't punk me out, so you won't make me look bad. It's a defense mechanism. What's lust? Except a defense mechanism against a world that scares me because I feel so separate from everybody in the universe and I feel so alone. And I don't know how to do intimacy, so I settle for lust and sex. It's a defective defense mechanism because it just makes you feel more lonely afterwards. And just like anger, you think anger is going to protect you, but if your rages and your violence and all that stuff actually attracts more hostility. And so I start saying this willingness prayer, and things start moving around in the universe and in my experience, slowly, very slowly. And one of the great things that I've always done service in Alcoholics Anonymous since I was brand new, and I've sponsored people since I've tried to sponsor people since I was brand new. I was horrid at it for a while because I didn't know what I was doing. But some guys started staying sober. I got one guy that's got over 35 years. I think he's my longest continuous sponsee. I was terrible in the beginning because I didn't know what I was doing. Because if you sponsor people, what happens is they become a reflection of you in a way that you never imagined. Sponsees and new people are often like ADD children. I mean, you got to keep your eye on them in your home group because, you know, sit up straight. Don't take that out of your mouth. Don't touch her. Stop that. You really got to kind of watch them, you know, because they're just spitting with good ideas, you know, just woo. You got to watch them. And just like kids, they will emulate Not your good, if you're a sponsor, they don't emulate. They watch for the negative stuff, and then they'll emulate that. Did you ever notice a little kid? You can have impeccable language around a little kid. Just say words like love and God, and just they never copy those words. You say the F word one time, they'll grab that out of the air and go around and say it everywhere they can. Just, oh my God, I did that as a kid. And sponsees are like that. They'll pick up your selfish behavior, their self-serving behavior, and they'll start emulating that. And if you're like me, I don't think you can sponsor people without falling in love with them to some degree. And then you start getting that you're the bad example in their life. Wow. Wow. And this is one way to become entirely ready. When you start to wake up, I was sitting in a restaurant one time with a bunch of guys I sponsor. I'll never forget this. And one of the guys is going on bad rapping all the people in our home group, everybody that's not at that table, he's talking crap about. And I got fed up with it. And I finally said, stop it. Just stop that. Where do you get that from anyway? And one of the other guys starts laughing. I said, what are you laughing at? He said, well, you were doing that last week. Ooh. And I was, too. Well, I wasn't really gossiping. I was informing people. I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed. And I really came away with that from a desire, somewhat a desire to not do that anymore. But I still didn't represent someone who was entirely ready or entirely willing. There's an old adage that without God, I can't, but without me, he won't. There's another old adage that willingness without action is fantasy. And everywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, it seems to be a call for action. It's as if I have to show up in life like I mean this stuff, and then God does the rest. I show up, position myself as if I mean it, and I catch the grace, and God takes me where, just like a sail catching the wind on a boat. It takes you where you need to do, but you got to learn how to set the sail. And so I realized, I started thinking about, what does it look like to become entirely willing or entirely ready? And I started, you know, there's an analogy in the 12 steps and 12 traditions where they pose the question, how come none of us have all our defects of character removed? And then it goes to say, because some of us never hit the bottom with these individual defects that we did with drinking. And what happens when you hit a bottom with drinking? How do you represent yourself? I don't know about you, but I'll tell you what I looked like. If you would have watched me in my first year of sobriety, you'd have seen a guy going to 15 to 20 meetings a week. You'd have seen a guy who was afraid to make a move without talking to his sponsor. You'd see a guy who was saying yes to every service commitment and thing Alcoholics Anonymous put in front of him. You would have seen a guy who looked a little squirrely, but you couldn't help but look at me and say, well, for nothing else, he's willing. Because I was showing up like someone who was willing. And what I've discovered in my life, if I can do the same thing with anything else that plagues me, if I can demonstrate through my actions that same level of willingness, I know for sure in time it's taken away. I've had this happen so many times. I remember in my first couple years, 3 years of sobriety, I tried to quit smoking three times. And I tell you, I couldn't. I could not quit. The best I ever did was 3 weeks of misery. It was so bad that I had friends of mine in AA wanting to buy me cigarettes. If I just, they want, no, really, they just, you shouldn't quit. You're better off smoking. Just smoke. And I just got so demoralized by it that I surrendered. I knew I couldn't quit. I knew I don't have what it takes. Some of you may have run into that problem in other areas. Gossip, lust, gambling, all kinds of stuff. Anger, rage, depression, where you just obsessively think about yourself and you spiral into the pit. Maybe you've had this, and you can't will it away. You can't make it go away. And I couldn't stop smoking. And it's funny how God works. He's a great choreographer. I was involved in General Services, DCM, and I went to a PRASA, which we have as a Pacific Region Area Service Assembly. And I was on a panel, and between sessions, I was sitting in the coffee shop, and I was overhearing a conversation between two AA members from San Francisco in the next booth. And the guy said something, got my attention. The one guy said, "So when did you quit smoking?" And the other guy said, "Oh, I never quit." And the other guy said, "Well, did you ever smoke?" And he said, "Oh yeah, over 2 packs a day." And he said, "Well, you must have quit somewhere, because I've known you for 6 years. I've never seen you smoke." And the other guy said, "Well, actually, I haven't had a cigarette in about 8. And he said, "Well, then you quit." He said, "No, I didn't. I couldn't quit." And he said, I don't understand. What'd you do?" He said, I realized the truth. I couldn't quit. So I just started asking God for the desire not to smoke without the intention of quitting. And I remember, I was sitting there listening, and I thought, well, I can't quit, but I could do that. I could just say those words. What would I have to lose? I'll say them a couple times a day, matter of fact. And I came home the next morning. I'm lighting up a cigarette as I'm saying to God, "Hey, I'm not quitting, but, you know, if you want to give me the desire not to smoke, that'd be cool." You know, really. And I'm not quitting. I would tell him, "I ain't quitting. I ain't going to do that to myself again. I am not quitting." And I did that. A couple times a day, I just say, you know, I'd ask him for the desire not to smoke, and I'm not going to quit. And I bet you it was probably 6 months of that. Every day. 6 months of expressing through my actions a willingness. And I woke up one morning and something had shifted inside me. I was afraid to believe it. And I remember I had the cigarettes laying right there next to my bed in the ashtray. I woke up and I didn't reach for the cigarette. And I just said, "Thank you for the desire not to smoke. And I'm not quitting. But I'm not going to light that first one just yet." I haven't had a cigarette since. That was 30-some years ago. And I didn't do that. I didn't do that. And this is not a fluke. I've told at least 10 people about that, and they've done the same thing. The problem is we have short attention spans, and God doesn't work quickly. I mean, we all want to say a prayer and have balloons fall from heaven and to change it, but it doesn't work like God's very slow because he's very old. You can't give God the bum's rush, man. I'm telling you, one of the hardest things is to persist in a willingness, because you're really persisting at positioning yourself to catch the grace. And it takes a while. I did the same thing with gambling. And I'll tell you, defects are funny because they come back, and they come back in different forms. I didn't place a bet for about 25 years. I hit a bottom at a year and a half sober. Terrible, terrible bottom with gambling. I didn't place a bet for almost 20 some years. And then I retired. I sold my company, got a lot of money. Crazy, crazy money. And my head said to me, this is not the good voice either. This is the one you should stay away from. It said, "Well, you need to invest that. Should put it in the stock market." The better voice said, "Oh, Bob, that's like gambling. The bad voice said, no, it's not, it's investing. And maybe if you weren't like me, it would be. But I took some money and I put it in the stock market, and within 6 months, I'm on the computer 6-7 hours a day. You can't get in my car without listening to Jim Cramer or Bloomberg. I mean, I'm reading stuff. At one point, I was so insane, I had $1 million in margin, which, if you don't know anything about the stock market, let me just tell you something, that'll make you insane. That will give you shifts. I mean, that'll just blow the top of your, one day, you're the smartest guy in the world. The next day, you're wondering if you should just kill yourself. I mean, it's like this roller coaster ride. It's brutal. And I can't stop. And it's not about the money. It's about the spiritual condition. And I can't stop. And I'll tell you, the day that it started to change, I thank God I've always sponsored people. A guy I sponsored called me up in the morning, and he's having a bad time. He's in a relationship breakup, and he's frightened. He's in a bad space. And he's talking to me, and I'm on the computer, and I'm trading. And I'm just got my phone here. I'm going, uh-huh, uh-huh. And he said, what's that noise? He could hear the keys on the computer. I said, no, it's nothing. He said, you're on the computer, aren't you? I was just looking at something. He said, you're trading stocks, aren't you? Well, I was watching. I was just looking at something. I'm listening. He said, you're not listening to me, are you? I said, yes, I am. He said, what did I just say? Oh, man. Because I'm uh-huhing him, and the truth is, I'm not really listening. I'm so obsessed with what I'm doing here. And I had to cop to it. I tell you, I was very ashamed of myself. I realized that I was becoming a terrible sponsor because this was owning me. That I'm not even, I'm putting, what Chamberlain used to say, anything you put between you and God and you and other people will cut you off from the sun. And that's exactly what I did. And that's what it says in step 7, in the 7-step prayer. We're not asking God to take away the things that stand in the way of my being happy or successful. I'm asking him to take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness. And I was ashamed of myself. And you'd think that would be enough to get me to quit. I still couldn't quit. I went through days of saying to myself, that's it, I'm not going to do that. And I couldn't. I'm seduced right back into trading again. But I started to pray. And I started to ask God seriously every day, please just take this up off me. I can't stop. I need your help. And I started having these conversations with God, and it was about probably 5 months, maybe 6, I don't know. I didn't keep track. And I got up one morning, and I just got out of bed, and I went right to the computer, and I sold everything, and I didn't even look at the price. And I knew I was free. And I haven't been back to that. I haven't done that again since then. I had a problem with anger. I was sober a number of years, and I went off on a guy. I had some of my, we caught him stealing. And I'm not talking about small stealing. He'd stole a lot. And I had two of my employees caught him, and they had him spread-eagled over the trunk of his car. And I got there before the police, and we're waiting for the police to come. And I just, when I saw him, I did something to this day I'm ashamed of. I took him by the hair, and I just started banging his head against the hood of that car over and over and over again until one of my employees grabbed me and said, don't do that. The police are on their way. You're going to get in trouble. You're going to make marks. And I stopped. And then it was like I came out of a whiteout or something. You know, this rage had come over me. And I was so ashamed of myself. Because the guy, here's the sad part, the guy was a potential member of AA, right? I thought, what a terrible example of Alcoholics Anonymous I was to him. And so I thought, I don't want to do this. I can't, I hadn't had an incident in a little while, and I don't want to have any more. And I started really talking about God, to God about this. And you know what it, you know what it is? It's that I'm afraid. He threatened me, threatened my finances and my family, and I had a young baby at the time, and I was scared. And the problem was I wasn't trusting God. And so I start, and I have not, that's been, I haven't had I haven't had a thing like that in 20, 25 years now. That's amazing to me. I wish I could take credit for it, but I didn't. So I say in the seventh step prayer, I'm asking God to take away these things that stand in the way of my usefulness. And I think that's perfect. You know, over the years, I've known a lot of happiness. I'll tell you, it's fleeting. I've had a lot of abundance. I've had a lot of stuff in my life. It's fleeting. But there's something about usefulness that changes your whole relationship to the universe and makes everything just right. There's a rightness about it. I remember watching old-timers when I was new, and I was so just spinning out with my emotions and so uncomfortable. And some of these old-timers, not all of them, some old-timers looked like they needed a drink, but there was some. There was some that looked like, man, they walked around with what appeared to be a confidence. I found out later it's not a confidence. It's not self-confidence. It's God-confidence. They walked through life as if they knew exactly who they were and exactly what their life was about. I didn't have any of that. I don't know who I am. I'm so many different people to so many. I don't even know who I am. And as far as what my life's about, I anguish over where I should work and what I should do when I grow up. I have no direction. I'm like a loose cannon in my life. And here are these people that know, that just have an assuredness about themselves. And you know something? What I perceived in them was exactly right. They did know exactly who they were. They were armed properly with information about themselves, and they had put it to good use in helping others for years. And they knew now, as a result of those actions, they knew what their life was about. It wasn't about them. It was about helping others. And you know something, when you think about it, we are divinely crafted by our failures, misery, pain, suffering, and mistakes to be uniquely useful to the person walking into Alcoholics Anonymous who suffers like we suffer. A doctor or a psychiatrist with 5 doctorate degrees cannot help that person because they can't do something that everyone in this room can do. They cannot experientially go within themselves to the place that that person's at until you really get them and you get their pain and you understand them and then approach them from that point of view. Do you ever have the experience of working with a newcomer and you start to tell them a little bit of their of your story and you're slanting it, hoping they're going to identify, and they sit there and they start nodding their head and then they'll say crazy things. How did you know all? How can we be this so much alike? And a bridge is formed over this abyss of separation. And from that, the book says nothing good can happen until this is accomplished. And then once the alcoholic, the guy you're working with, starts to connect with you, then there's hope. And the hope is, first of all, I'm not alone. Oh my God, this guy's, I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but he's sick like I'm sick. And yet, something has happened to him. He seems pretty comfortable sober. As the book says, his very deportment shouts that's of someone who's found something here. And I start, and if you're new, maybe the new guy's lucky enough to hope. He's been afraid to hope because his hopes have been dashed over and over and over and over again. But maybe now, because he's made a connection with you, he dares to hope. And the hope is that maybe if I did what everything you did, could what has happened to you happen to me? I'll tell you something. I've known some great happiness. I've gotten some seven-figure checks. I've bought some amazing automobiles. I've taken some great trips. And I'll tell you, the shine of all of that stuff wears off quick. But there is nothing like the feeling that you get after you make that connection of usefulness with a guy and you start bringing him into the solution. And then you go home that night and man, everything is perfect. Everything is perfect. You're exactly who you're supposed to be, doing exactly what you're supposed to do. There's no more questions. There's no more confusion. There's just a rightness about everything because you're finally fulfilling your divine purpose, the thing that you've been crafted for by your pain and misery. Isn't it odd that some of the things we loathe in ourselves the most, our deepest, darkest secrets that we're just so ashamed of, I guarantee you, you'll find yourself sometime in your sobriety sharing that one deep, dark, shameful secret with someone, and you will be free of it for all time because you've made it useful. A year after that, you'll be sharing it at a podium. You'll go, how'd I do that? Right? How'd I do that? Because you're free of it. What an amazing thing that happens as a result of usefulness. I'll take it every time. Little thing about I think sometimes when Chamberlain used to say this is a process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding, part of the discovery is to discover the truth that these defects of character that I think are defense mechanisms aren't helping, they're making things worse. Now there may have been a time 20 years ago when it helped, when you went off and acted like a crazy, rageful person and you backed someone off. Now, 20 years later, it's gotten you into a lot of conflict and a lot of separation and a lot of loneliness. It's not working. It's not working. And you're starting to wake up to the truth. And as that's happening, hopefully something else is happening. You've had enough experiences in sobriety with God that you're starting to trust him a little bit. There was a TV show on when I was a kid called Rescue 8. And there was this one episode where these two paramedics came out of the firehouse to go help distressed people. In this one episode, they come upon this scene, and there's this little girl, a cute little girl, but she's crying hysterically and seems to be in pain, and her arm is wedged up inside a vending machine, and her mother and father are there, and they've been trying to get the arm out, and it just hurts her. They can't get it out. It's stuck up in there, and they don't know what to do. And now the fire trucks are showing up, and the firemen are unloading acetylene torches and electric saws, and they're talking about plans of cutting the door off around the girl's arm, which is freaking this little girl out, freaking the parents out. And the one paramedic's watching the whole thing. And he walks over and he kneels down next to the little girl. And he says, sweetheart, do you have something in your hand? She goes, uh-huh. What do you got in your hand? She says, a candy bar. Will you let go of it? No! It's my candy bar! It's my candy bar! It's my anger! It's my gossip! It's my porno! It's my gambling! It's my sugar! She ain't letting go of that candy bar. And he gets it. And he backs away. Stands there for about a minute and watching her, and then he comes back over and kneels down to her. And she's looking at him like, what do you want? And he said, sweetheart, I'm just here to make you a promise. And she said, what? He said, I will promise you two brand new candy bars if you'll let go of that crumpled one up that's no good anymore. And she says, really? And he says, I promise you. And because she trusts, she lets go of the candy bar and her arm slides out of the vending machine. What's your candy bar? Do you really want it? How's that been working for you? Do you trust God that he'll replace it? If you let go of it, he'll bring something else into your life? I've watched guys stay in brutal relationships for years. It just, oh, God, oh, you got another black eye, do you? Oh, yeah, she loves me. Yeah. Why don't you get out of that one? Oh, I don't know if I'd ever find anybody as good to me as her. What? What? What are you talking about? But he's afraid to let go of the candy bar, right? And it's a worthless candy bar. And they say that when one door closes, another opens up. But you got to get your fingers out of the one that closed. Let's take an 8-minute break.